Building Bridges, your community and labor report. Happy New Year. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges,
Dr. Michelle Bachelet, frontrunner for the presidency of Chile.
But first, we have with us on the line now Dr. William Spriggs, who's a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute. What are some of the economic policies that we can expect to be voiced by Mr. Bush?
He's already been active working on Social Security, and he is promising some type of tax reform as well. So those are going to be his two biggest initiatives, and we're going to see some inklings of what he plans to do about the budget deficit that has been growing under his administration. Some of that budgeting we saw at the end of his term when Congress started to make cuts in programs. They are going to have to make even more drastic cuts in program this year to try and keep to his pledge of making the deficit not grow as much. And we've already seen his trial balloon about Social Security, where he has now quite actively committed himself to privatizing the system. We haven't heard the details of his tax reform yet.
Dr. Spriggs, when we talk about, or rather when Bush talks about privatizing the Social Security system, what exactly does that mean? There have been reports that we have an indication of what direction he wants to take the system, or how he wants to destroy it, actually. So why don't you just flesh that out for us?
Well, he is going to destroy the system as it currently runs and as Americans currently experience the program. The program is an insurance program. He has been out there touting it as a retirement program. So right away, he's going to destroy the program. The program would be nothing at all like what Americans currently experience. As an insurance program, it is a seamless program between the old age program, the survivors program, and the disability program. The program insures families. It does not just meet the need of an individual worker. It's designed to insure a family. If at age 57 you have a stroke and become disabled, your family will get a benefit. That benefit will not change when you become 62 and actually start drawing money from the old age insurance. And if you die at age 64, then your family continues to get the same benefits, even though now they are getting it from the survivors pool, because every worker with the same earnings history gets the same benefit, regardless of whether they are in disability, old age, or survivors. So when he says he is going to have a private account to an individual worker, then you got to go, well, how are you going to do that? Because currently, that's not how the program works. Only half of the current recipients of Social Security are retired workers getting their retirement benefit. The other half are the spouse of a retired worker, the children of retired workers. Those who talk about privatization don't say, where would the spousal benefit come from? Where would the child benefit come from? And when they talk about getting back to the benefit level for the retired worker, they don't talk about where would the family get this other pile of money. You have disabled workers, their spouse, their children, and you have widow and widowers and children who get the survivor's checks. So this is a very complex program built around the nuclear family. So that's not included in the way that the privatizers work. So first and foremost, he would totally shatter the program. It would not be a family-based program. It would not be an insurance for the family, because the accounts, as he has presented them, as his commission studied them, talk nothing about the other half of the beneficiaries. The other part that he's going to do to rip it up is that from time to time, as the program began, Congress adjusted the benefit level so that retirees could retire in a way something close to what their earnings over their lifetime had been. Finally, in the 1960s and 70s, Congress decided that they should have an automatic formula to reflect the workers' earnings instead of having to make these annual adjustments. So what we went to is a way of defining the benefit based on your actual earnings, and that means that we index the benefit level to your wage history. That's called wage indexing. And cutting the benefit, what the president is saying is he's not going to base benefits on your work history. He's just going to set the benefit level and then increase it by inflation. What that means is you would not retire as you earn money today. So if you wanted to go out and replace your color television, you couldn't, because you would be retiring for the lifestyle of someone in 1961. So you might be replacing a black and white TV, but you wouldn't be replacing a color TV. So you would have retired to the lifestyle of someone in the 1960s, not the lifestyle that you have today, not based on your earnings. This would be based on, you know, your parents or your grandparents' lifestyle at the time that they retired. It is a real benefit cut, because instead of replacing your earnings, we're now just saying, here's a benefit level, and that's all we're going to do for you is maintain a benefit level. And as lifestyles and earnings have increased over time, you just simply would not be able to do that. And so he's talking for the youngest generation, those who I now call them the ABC generation. We used to do X, Y, and Z, but they're the ABC generation because they're about to be clobbered.
And the transitioning of accounts of Social Security funds to private accounts, what is so wrong with that? Why is that posit in your mind such detriment for the future of Social Security?
Well, in two ways. One, the philosophical shift that he's making. He's changing a program which is based on family insurance to a private retirement. So first is we're creating a new philosophy, which we don't currently have out there. So this is the most anti-family, anti-marriage change ever, because the current program has a marriage and family bonus, and it has a single penalty to it. He's changing it so that it has a single bonus and a marriage penalty. That's what he's doing. So first is the change to be anti-family. This, in no unmistakable terms, in no unmistakable way, is the most anti-family transition of the program ever.
You can't, so much for the rhetoric of family values.
Oh, this would be straight from the kingdom of fire and Hades from the people who love family values, because this program is specifically designed around a man married to a woman with some children. That's how the benefit is defined, and it gives a bonus to them to the detriment of single people. So this is a transfer from single people to married families. So that's a huge transition. But the second thing is the president is trying to tell everybody there's this calamity in Social Security based on what the Social Security trustees say, which is that when we get to the year 2042, that the trust fund will only be able to pay 80 cents on the dollar of current benefit levels. So the problem is we don't have enough revenues to meet the benefits. When he says he's going to privatize, he makes the problem worse because he's taking money out. He's reducing the revenue stream. So you're sitting there and you're scratching your head and you go, okay, he says there's a crisis because there's not enough money going into Social Security to keep it solvent, so he's going to solve it by taking money out. You go, whoa, how does that add up? We're not getting enough money in the system, but he's going to take money out and that solves the problem. I don't get it. Well, the get it part, which is why this generation is the about-to-be-clobbered generation, the get it part is he does it by cutting benefits enough to make up for the outflow of the revenue plus the shortfall that would occur when that generation goes to retire. So that's how this works out. It is nothing more than window dressing to the youngest generation, the about-to-be-clobbered generation, who will have to continue to pay the taxes to current retirees and then pay for it by having tremendously reduced benefits. That's what the deal is. So it's 20-somethings in this ABC generation who think that, oh, wow, this is going to be great. I get to, you know, have my private account, should be holding on to their wallets because they're going to get clobbered.
And what does this do to the federal budget? What are the transition costs that would need to be raised to make the transition itself?
Well, this is the real calamity, because the president isn't looking at a true crisis. The true crisis that we are facing is that the entire United States is living off of borrowed money from Japan and from China in particular. we actually have had a capital outflow under this president in the sense that our position on equities have gone down, so that people are moving money out of the United States to make investment in other countries. So we've had a capital outflow in terms of equity investment. So we have been borrowing money. So here's a country that is up to debt to the wazoo, and he is saying, I'm just going to write another check on an account which has no money in it. It's just going to bounce. You're just going to have to go borrow more money. So the future generation is going to be left paying back China and Japan for this folly. Now, is it a good thing for us to go further into debt to China and to Japan so that we can have young people put money in the stock market who will then, when they retire, have significantly reduced benefits? That seems like a losing deal all the way around. It's mind-boggling. And he brings us to the teetering point, because if for any reason the rest of the world looks at our position and says, you guys keep running federal deficits, you're totally ignoring that you're a debtor nation. You keep saying you want to borrow more money. Your individuals have incomes which have stagnated over the last 4 years. They are personally running up debt. When are y'all going to pay it back? And because people have such faith in the United States, they're continuing to lend us the money, but at some point, you have to think that the gravy train could shift, and particularly this president, because he seems to have a way of ticking off the international world. You know, if you're borrowing money, at some point, people start to make claims about how you behave, and that day of reckoning may come in the next 4 years if they see him continue to act irresponsibly on matters like the deficit, on our trade account, where this immediate problem. We've already had the dollar fall 16%. If a smaller country stops believing in us, or a smaller country runs into problem, if oil prices were to spike and felt that for whatever reason they needed to get out of dollar-denominated debt and needed to go to some other standard like the euro, where there's actually an appreciation of the currency, then you could see this go out of control, because China, which holds so much of our debt, may feel that that's not the best position to be in, and they may feel that they need to hold euros as well to diversify their portfolio and protect themselves against further depreciation of these dollar debts that they hold. If that happens, then our interest rates will spike, as they did in the late 1970s, and because of the personal debt level that individuals have and the position they've taken in their homes and the debt they've taken in their homes, we could see the home market grind to an instant halt if the interest rates went that high. And we might see ourselves back as we did in the 1980s when we tried to solve the last dollar crisis with a huge recession. The last time we had this dollar crisis, we ended up with that horrible recession of the 1980s. So that's not inconceivable. That's not out of the ballpark if we go and borrow the next 10 years, the $2 trillion it would need to finance going over to private accounts, the $15 trillion we would have to borrow over the next 15 to 20 years in order to do this.
And what's the website so people can glean a great deal more?
The website for the Economic Policy Institute is www.epinet.org.
Dr. William Spriggs, thank you for joining us.
Yo no canto por cantar, ni por tener buena voz. Canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido.
A woman is leading for the presidential nomination of Chile's ruling coalition for the first time ever. The woman, socialist Michelle Bachelet, is competing for the nomination of the center-left multi-party coalition that has been in power in Chile since the end of General Pinochet's regime in 1990. Dr. Bachelet would easily beat the presumptive opposition nominee from a Santiago mayor, Joaquin Lavin, according to opinion polls from Chile. Lavin is a leader of the pro-Pinochet Independent Democratic Union. Dr. Bachelet is the first woman to ever hold the position of Minister of Defense in any Latin American country. She and her mother both survived torture under the Pinochet regime in the 1970s. Her father, a prominent general, was tortured to death in 1974. Bachelet previously served as the country's Minister of Health. Dr. Bachelet has stated, "One reason women have begun to appear as relevant figures is that we represent a type of humanization of politics closer to how people see themselves." The Global Labor Institute of the Cornell School of Industrial Labor Relations hosts a reception for Dr. Bachelet. And now let's hear from Dr. Michelle Bachelet, introduced by Stan Gasek, AFL-CIO International Affairs Assistant Director, responsible for the Federation's relations with Latin America and the Caribbean.
Good evening to all our sisters and brothers in the New York labor movement. Muy buenas noches a todos y a todas. President John Sweeney indicated to me yesterday he wanted the personal greeting to be extended to our guest of honor on behalf of the 13 million working men and women which the AFL-CIO represents. Some of my colleagues at the AFL-CIO were asking me earlier before this event, is this going to be an endorsement by the AFL-CIO with regard to a political candidacy? And, of course, it really is very inappropriate, I think, for a labor movement of another country to actually make an endorsement with regard to a presidential race and election in another country. It's going to be a matter for the Chilean people to decide. But I also recall that comment by Samuel Gampers, president, founder of the American Federation of Labor, when he was asked about political action in the context of the AFL officially having a nonpartisan position, to which he replied, "But we will always reward our friends and punish our enemies." And we really will see that Dr. Michelle Bachelet is one of our friends. Sister Bachelet has indeed been a friend in terms of her entire life and the life of her family, particularly of her father, and particularly of her mother, actually have represented actually a continuing legacy for social justice. To paraphrase the words of Martin Luther King, I think that we're seeing that the arc of justice is bending towards Chile in a number of ways. It started to bend towards Chile in the 1988 plebiscite when the no to Pinochet prevailed. And it's been bending further, and very, very recently, with President Lagos declaring all the reports should be opened with regard to victims of torture and murder. And we see the arc of justice bending further in it, that it looks as if General Pinochet is finally going to be standing trial, which we certainly, all of us, we certainly hope so. We see the arc of justice bending towards Chile insofar as the center-to-left candidates prevailed in the municipal elections in Chile. And we see the arc of justice bending towards Chile when we look at Sister Bachelet and we see that in the latest polls that she's leading with 52% and that her next competition, the right-wing candidate, Joaquin Lavín, is trailing well behind in the 20 percentiles. So this is all very, very encouraging. What I would consider to be the eje de bien, or actually the axis of good in Latin America. But it is precisely by looking at our good friend and brother, Lula, in Brazil, at the Néstor Kirchner government in Argentina, and the victory of Tabaré Vázquez in Uruguay is further evidence of this axis of good continuing. And if there is the victory of Dr. Bachelet, this axis of good will be all the more reinforced. Entonces, compañera Bachelet, le deseamos a usted realmente todo el éxito. Y sí se puede.
Sister and brothers, I'm very happy to be here. We Chileans have, I could say, an historical debt with the labor movement of the United States because you were by our side in the very difficult moment of our history. We did have a lot of solidarity and support from you, and we know that and we don't forget it. But we also had a lot of support in order that President Lagos, who is the current president of our country, could be elected, trying to build a country that has a more profound democracy, that has economical growth, so we could, those benefits, be part of a better being and life for everyone of our country. And now I am the first on the polls, but as Winston Churchill says, in politics, 5 minutes can be a whole life. So you'll never know what will happen. But we will still continue working in order to be the first female president of the Republic. But not only because that would be also a historical issue, but more important because even though Chile, as you may know, has been doing pretty well, it's a democracy well consolidated. The civilian and military relationship has been, I would say, normalized. And I'm very proud to say I play a role in that too. And we have people living better than so many years, but we still have a lot of challenges. And some of our challenges are how we can deal with all the inequalities that our society still have. We have inequalities. We have a dismal income distribution in our country. We have inequalities, gender inequalities. We have inequalities between the city and the rural areas and so on. So because we have been having a lot of achievement, it is ethically, socially, and politically indispensable that we can make a better life for all the Chileans. So my program will be, in that sense, how we can help all the people, all the workers, to have a quality of life the one they deserve. And that means that we want to build a just country, a more caring country, a country that everybody feels that it belongs to them, a country where the workers' rights are respected, where they can have they are part of a movement and they are also integrated part of the country. And in that sense, all the programs, the ideas that we want to develop, of course they're not easy. We will receive a big struggle against that because of the kind of things we want to do. Because I am a woman, and that is also very complicated in a machist country like mine. But I have to say, I have to pass a commercial. I not only was the first Minister of Defense in Chile, I was the first Minister of Defense in the region, because even the best developed countries in the region has never had a woman in this kind of works and task. So I know I have a lot of challenges, but we have the force, we have the right, and we have your help. So thank you very much.
Dr. Bushelet, interestingly, was a former Secretary of Defense, albeit under the government of Ricardo Lagos. But she was also imprisoned by, and her father, a member of the Allende government, was tortured to death by members of the coup of General Augusto Pinochet. She discusses her response to Pinochet and the issue of reparations for his victims.
Because of my history, my biography, because of what I have to live, that we have to solve correctly our problem from the past, but not with silence, with truth and justice, but also with reparation. That's why when I was the Minister of Defense, I had no problem to work with that. Many people ask me, how could you work with the militaries with your history? But on the contrary, because of my history, because I'm sure that my history doesn't intend me to go into revenge. On the contrary, I want to help build a country where we can all look at our eyes, we can all walk tall with dignity, and that where we can democratize our society so different opinions are not a threat, are seen as more a way to make our society more rich, more open-minded, I would say. And in that sense, I would tell you, when I work with the militaries, I try to do many things. One of them is to normalize the relationship between the civil and military group. Second of all, what I would like is a Chile that integrates all the Chileans through reparation to all the people who suffer. We have passed some laws, but they're still in the Congress, so we can give the dignity of all the people who suffer. And also we have a historic and political reparation because all these people have been recognized. I mean, everybody knows today in the country what really happened, and that's important in order to have a moral reparation, I would say. And on the other hand, there are some more economic reparations who have been discussing right now in the parliament. We should try to build a society where everybody respects each other, even though we think different. We have different ways of thinking how we solve the inequalities of our society, but we are all citizens with rights and with the right to organize ourselves, trying to achieve the kind of society that we all dream.
Dr. Bushelet addresses the economic disparity and distribution of wealth amongst the Chilean people.
You know, Chile has been growing pretty well. It's a democracy. It's stable politically, economically. In that sense, I would say it's going well. But of course, if you look to the income distribution, it's very bad. It's dismal. And we need to improve that. It's not easy, you know. I've been studying how you can change that, how you can produce social mobility. And the answer that you find everywhere is education, education, education. And in that sense, education will be my priority anyway. an education from the very beginning of their life, because inequality starts from birth in our country. A child who is born in a poor house don't have the same alternatives as somebody who is born in the house of professionals, of clinicians, people with cultural level, with education, with employment. So I will try to do a very good educational program so everybody will have the opportunities of their life. But also, I think we should continue and with stronger social policies that will compensate through good health programs, good educational programs, housing programs, welfare programs that will improve the quality of the life of all the Chileans. And I'll continue seeking and looking for answers in order what else we can do to improve this income distribution. One important issue is how we can increase the participation of women in the labor force. Today is very low, only 35%. That's too slow. We have to decrease the poverty. We have decreased it in this government to the half. It was, in the three governments of the Concertación. In the 90s was 40%, now it's 18%, but still unacceptable. So we have to see a lot of different policies to see how we can decrease poverty and make more equal and more just the conditions of life in Chile. And also, we have decided that we have to put a royalty to the copper minings, because people have been investing there but are not paying any royalty, and they are paying it all over the world, but not in Chile. And we needed that because copper in some moment will finish, and it's not a renewable resource. We need to spend that money in more development and research so we can help our industry. Because when copper is finished, what are we going to do? We have to be able to produce other kinds of products, develop other kinds of the industry so our country can continue existing.
You've been listening to Dr. Michelle Bachelet, the front runner for the post of President of Chile, elections to be held next December.
This has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special.
Siempre será canción nueva.